Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Today we talk performance anxiety with fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi. I should say culinary performance anxiety. Isaac is the master of charmingly off-the-wall naivete, and it plays big time in his cooking and entertaining. Well, strawberries are up there with tomatoes. It's hard to get a good one. LA Times' Russ Parsons knows this berry literally from the ground up, and he's got some tips. It's a new era in house wines. Some unexpected buys are to be had. Food & Wine magazine's wine writer Letty Teague fills us in. Then I take on a new challenger in Stump the Cook with our celebrity stumpmaster Christopher Kimball, he of America's Test Kitchen fame. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll the way we do every week with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, you two have not talked about coffee in a dog's age. Have there been any coffee finds?
The entire city of Portland is a great coffee find.
Portland, yes. Oregon.
Yes.
Portland, Oregon. Portland, Maine.
I mean, Seattle is better known, but Portland is every bit as coffee crazed with countless really great coffee houses where they're serious about making their espresso. You can get French press coffee, whatever you like. There's a place in Portland that we love called Crema. It's a coffee shop and also a terrific bakery, because as much as I love coffee, and I do, it's not complete without some terrific pastries to go alongside of it.
Well, you know, Voodoo Donuts is right around there. And what I like to do is take the Voodoo Donuts and bring them over to Crema.
Oh, no.
Oh, no!
That's wrong, because if you do that, then you're not going to be eating one of Crema's cheddar corn biscuits.
I know.
Is one of the great, it's a kind of a squat circle that is all like crusty and chewy with baked cheese and dotted with sweet corn kernels. I mean, that
it is
along
wonderful.
With a coffee that's a little bit sweet, you know, like maybe like the Spanish latte that is made with sweetened condensed milk rather than regular milk. That and a corn biscuit is a great, great breakfast.
Okay.
Where is this place in Portland?
2728 Southeast and Kenny Street.
So is that?
I'm sure it's a neighborhood, but you know, now that we have a GPS, we pay no attention to where
to
we are
where
except
we are.
For the address.
As long as the GPS doesn't start recalculating,
right,
you know, we just glide on in.
All right, but here's the big test. If you call a coffee place Crema, you know, Crema is that foam, that little bit of natural
exactly.
coffee foam on top of the espresso
yeah.
that supposedly you can float a sugar packet on. I mean, do they do Crema?
Yes.
They do. I don't know if you could float a sugar packet.
It's like a Guinness stout with a great head on it.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, this is one of those places that it's not just like a blob of stuff on top. It's a beautiful kind of leafy pattern.
Mm.
You know, so it's like espresso art, each little cup of it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, this sounds awfully good.
And it's really good. And did we mention the cranberry caramel pecan bundt cake or the double chocolate earthquake cookies?
Is this one of those places where people can hang out all day and, you know, just...
Yes.
I think every place in Portland, Oregon, you can hang out all day.
I think it's Wi-Fi equipped and, you know, you can just sit there and drink coffee and eat pastries all day long.
Yeah, it's very Hamish-a. Do you know that word?
Oh, yeah, homie.
Right? Homie, very good.
Homie.
Very good.
Hey,
Hamish-a,
remember, I'm from New York
place.
Originally. I've got stuff down.
Everybody has to know tchotchke and Hamish-a.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you know you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Last night, I was thinking as I pulled together supper from bits and pieces that we had on hand that one of the things that I rely on over and over are leftover pan juices. Now, by pan juices, I mean whenever you stew or roast or sauté, you save the pan juices in the refrigerator. Once the fat's hardened and you discard it, you can freeze them. Think of these as classy bouillon cubes. They give you really intense flavors for instant sauces or broths, and they're always different. So last night, I wanted to do big bowls of soup for dinner. I had a leftover spicy cabbage sort of stew, but I didn't have any broth. Well, enter my homemade bouillon cubes. Some water, the cabbage, 5 minutes of simmering, and then you finish the soup with a dash of vinegar and some chopped onion for crunch. Dinner. Total time, maybe 15 minutes if you include ferreting in the freezer. Do not let a scrap get by you, as a wise person said years ago. Much of the world lives on the kinds of food that we throw away, and they live very well. Award-winning food writer Russ Parsons has been tracking American agriculture for over 20 years. In fact, in his book, he lays out how our food is grown and how it gets to us. Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Russ, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
So, Russ, what in your mind is a great strawberry?
Well, probably the perfect strawberry is a Fraise Dubois, which is this, it's a wild strawberry. It's a tiny little thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's about the size of the last knuckle on your little finger.
Uh-huh.
It's got this kind of blooming flavor. It's sweet, but it's also got this depth. I mean, a great strawberry is one of those fruits that, like a great peach or a great tomato,
uh-huh,
it's a transporting quality. It's almost like a great wine. But it's almost impossible to find at retail. You can't go to the grocery store and find those because they're so fragile that shipping them, it turns to strawberry jam almost instantly.
But you can grow them, right?
You can grow them, and that's the best thing to do. They actually grow fairly easily. You want to grow it as an annual, not as a perennial.
Uh-huh.
So you need to put it in the ground every year.
Is there anything in commercial strawberries that really knock your socks off?
Right now, no. There are varietally labeled strawberries that you can find at farmers markets. The old varieties like Chandler, which isn't actually all that old, but the new varieties have been bred mainly for shipping. It's that old thing of, you know, be careful what you wish for because somebody might give it to you.
Uh-huh.
People love strawberries. They want strawberries all the time, all over, and so strawberry varieties have been developed to supply that need. Unfortunately, they don't taste like strawberries anymore, and they don't have that fragility. The modern varieties tend to be sweet but not complex in flavor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They tend to be almost crisp in texture, which is something that I find off-putting. Strawberries aren't supposed to be crisp. They're supposed to be kind of melting in texture.
Can you tell me some of the other names of the older varieties? Because, you know, in farmers markets, we could just ask for them.
In farmers markets, look for things like Klondikes. That's a great variety. The best thing to do is ask for a taste, because that's going to direct you to a farmer who really knows what they're doing. And strawberries are one of the great farmers market fruits, because when you get them that are grown locally, the farmer hasn't had to make any of those compromises for shipping or for handling or any of those kinds of things.
Mm.
They can choose varieties that are still fairly fragile and that have terrific flavor.
Now, do you refrigerate strawberries, or should they be left out on the counter?
That's one of those, you know, danged if you do and danged if you
uh-huh,
don't.
Uh-huh.
Strawberries are incredibly fragile, even the new varieties. And so they need to be refrigerated so that they don't spoil. On the other hand, refrigerating them, to me, dulls the flavor so that they're never as good as when you tasted them the first time. In an ideal world, what you would do is buy strawberries and eat them that day. But if you're going to store them, you might want to cut them up in advance and add sugar to them. One of the weird things about strawberries is that when they're heated, the color turns. And it turns this like this kind of bruised purple.
Mm-hmm.
Not a great thing.
Yeah.
But you can cook strawberries without any heat at all. Just apply sugar to them, and the sugar will draw out a lot of the moisture. It'll soften the berry, and it'll make a nice little sauce, especially if you're making something like a strawberry ice cream, you know, where the strawberries are going to be frozen.
Yeah.
It's really a good idea to sugar them a couple of hours in advance, because that'll soften the berries enough. It'll pull out enough of the moisture that the berries won't turn to ice cubes in the ice cream.
Yeah. How do you feel about washing them? There's always that debate about, you know, do you wash them or don't you, because they're so fragile.
Having spent time in the strawberry fields, I wash them. But definitely, definitely wash them right before you serve them. That skin is so delicate on a strawberry, it offers no protection whatsoever. If you wash strawberries when you get them home,
right.
Even refrigerated within a couple of hours, you'll start to see spoilage spots on them because the water that's on the surface has started to break down that membrane that protects them.
Oh, the poor little guys. Hey.
Poor little, they're fragile.
Yeah. Hey, Russ, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Russ Parsons writes for the LA Times, and he's author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Find Russ's recipe for strawberries and oranges in basil syrup on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our many examples of deathless prose and compelling dialogue, our newsletters, our podcasts, and information on our book, inspired by this very show, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. And let me tell you, there are definitely some opinions there. You'll find it all at splendidtable.org.
A present from you, strawberry.
Coming up, a fashionista in the kitchen, new house wine strategies, and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. You know that fantasy question, who would you like to have a meal with? Fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi has always struck me as a perfect person to include in that fantasy dinner. Funny, smart, opinionated, he's turned his life as a designer into TV, film, books, magazines, and even comic books. But most interestingly, we have discovered that he's a fine cook as well. Isaac, welcome.
Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure. Hello, Lynn.
You know, Isaac, I realize I've watched you on television. I've bought your clothes. But I never knew you cooked.
Well, you know what? I kind of don't really talk about it too much because I have anxiety about performance. You know, it's like if I've been cooking my whole life.
Right.
And, you know, if you tell people about that, then they come to expect great things when they come to your house for dinner. Do you know?
Oh, I know. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also, by the way, you know, God forbid you should say you're a good cook. And then someone remembers when you were 24 and you gave them bad oysters and they had like, you know, they were sick for 3 weeks and they say, oh, yeah, he's such a great cook, you know.
But how did you start? I mean, was it literally your mother taught you to cook?
Not really. I mean, she was a great cook, and I watched a lot. You know, I watched her a lot. But when I left home at the age of 20, I don't know how this happened, but the first thing I bought was a set of Le Creuset cookware, right? The first thing I bought. It's blue. I still have a lot of it. And it was like a set. You know, you bought, in those days, you bought it for like, you know, $150. And you think, oh, my God, I'm spending $150 on cookware, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was month's rent or something to spend that
amount of
money.
Right.
Yeah.
And also I got Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which is the Julia Child book.
Right.
I got volume 1. And I started cooking recipes from that book. And let me tell you, I mean, that's not an easy book to follow. That I made some of those recipes like a number of times until I figured out what she was talking about, you know? I mean, I started with bœuf bourguignon, you know, I went right to that. And I was in bed for a week after I made that, you know?
So today, I mean, do you have a kitchen of your dreams at this point and time to do any of this?
Well, that's, I mean, come on, does anyone have the kitchen of their dreams?
Well, I don't, but I like to think somebody does.
Well, I love my kitchen. Let's put it this way. I love my kitchen. I have a tiny kitchen in the city, which I never use, and it's kind of cursed, I have to say. Every time I try to entertain in the city, something goes wrong.
Uh-huh.
But then
uh-huh.
I have this little house in Bridgehampton, Long Island, and in that house, about 3 years ago, I redid it and made it the sort of kitchen of my dreams, with air quotes. I say it with air quotes.
I understand. You know? But now, do you get a chance to do a lot of entertaining? And how do you like to entertain when you do it?
Oh, God, Lynn, you bring up such a question. I mean, in my fantasy, I am a cross between, you know, James Beard and Martha Stewart, right? I'm always cooking for people, right?
Right, right.
But I don't know. In the reality of things, I get very chicken. And as I get older, I keep thinking it's harder and harder to cook for more than two people.
Why? I mean, I would have been, you have such bravado. Why?
I know. I don't know. You know, it's like laughing on the outside, crying on the inside, basically. I am a very complicated person. And where, like, every weekend I cook for my boyfriend like crazy, churning ice cream and desserts and baking and muffins in the morning and souffles. I mean, I really love cooking for him because somehow it's just easy and fun.
Right.
The minute you put like one more person in that equation or two more people in that equation, it just, I freeze up. I don't know what happens.
Huh.
I have like performance anxiety, you know?
So you don't have people over very often then? Or do you bring in caterers?
I bring in caterers when it's a lot of people. You know, I had some friends in for the Kentucky Derby thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And we decided, okay, well, we're going to invite Vance because she's this girl from Tennessee. And she has this incredible recipe that she got from her mother for, like, actual Southern fried chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the ingredients are chicken, flour, salt and pepper, and Crisco. I mean, those are all the ingredients for Southern fried chicken. And anyone who tries to tell you about buttermilk and, you know, breading or cornflakes or whatever, all of that business. I mean, it's delicious, but you have got to taste Vance's fried chicken. It's amazing. And it's like this whole alchemy of, like, you know, cooking it with the skin side down in the very, very hot Crisco and covering it and uncovering it and covering it. And it's like, you know, it is a kind of alchemy. And then the skin is like golden and very crisp and the meat is very juicy. I mean, it's really something incredible. So I thought, okay, now I'm having six people to dinner. Invite Vance and make her do it, you know? So it's like, oh, good, it's Vance's fault if it's messed up, you know? I'll make the side dishes, right?
Right.
This is a good idea. Because, you know, mac and cheese, how can you mess that up? It's carbohydrates with cheese, right?
Everybody exactly, likes that. Exactly.
And guess what? It wasn't as delicious as my normal macaroni and cheese is. Like, if I was just making it for Arnold, I wouldn't be so afraid.
So the anxiety thing really gets into it, doesn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. They should make a pill for it, like a sort of a cooking Viagra, so that you know that you'll always be able to perform when you're cooking.
But what do you think makes a gathering work?
Booze.
Uh-huh.
I'm not kidding.
Okay.
I've got to say, like, liquor. Liquor makes it really does. One thing about Kentucky Derby, we thought, oh, mint juleps, right?
Right.
So we made these mint juleps.
Right.
And everybody was happy. Nobody even noticed that things weren't up to par. Everybody was like, oh, it's delicious, it's delicious. But honestly, like a kind of a festive drink, like a drink d'occasion, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like
uh-huh.
If you make up a special kind of drink, and you say, like, this is, like, you know, you would never call it, like, a teeny anything, like an Isaac teeny. I would probably, like, kill myself before I did that. But if you make up some kind of a drink, like, even if it's not alcoholic,
yeah.
I swear, it really is like a conversation starter. Like, this is yerba mate, everybody, right? And they're like, yerba mate, what's that? And then suddenly that leads to, like, other discussions about caffeine and about, you know, Brazil or wherever yerba mate comes from. Do you know what I mean? The other thing, dessert. You know, the first thing you eat and the last thing you eat. I think those are, it's like in fashion, if your hair is right and your shoes are right,
right,
everything in between kind of is going to work. You
really?
Know? Well, that's what Dionne Vreeland said, and I think that's true.
Interesting.
I swear, it's like if the drink is right, right and the dessert is right, and I'm very good at dessert. That's one thing. I am kind of good at – I'm getting even better at dessert.
Well, you mentioned the ice cream that you love to
do. Well, like, you know, you can't go wrong if you make ginger ice cream. You can't go wrong if you make mint chocolate chip ice cream. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And then if you bake something to pair it with, you know, I have this great book – The Chez Panisse Dessert Book by Lindsay Shear. Do you know that book?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Oh, my God. That book, I mean, that, speaking of alchemy, and she really does a good job of describing what she's talking about. I mean, she will tell you, like, sift this part of the flour and don't sift that. I mean, it's so specific.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Turn on
and
the light. Really, yeah.
That's right. That's
yeah, exactly.
But you know what? Those little tiny bits of information help me as a chef. You know, they really do.
Isaac, thank you. This has been a revelation.
For me, too. I'm such a big fan of the show. I was just dying to come on. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. You're a doll.
Designer Isaac Mizrahi is creative director for Liz Claiborne. And his book, How to Have Style, is going to be out in October of 2008. Wine Magazine's Letty Teague checks out the wine scene from a lot of different angles and drops by from time to time to fill us in on her finds. Letty, good to have you back.
Great to be here, as always.
You know, Letty, I want to talk about ordering the restaurant's house wine. Most of the wine lovers I know would never dream of doing that, but I gather you disagree, don't you?
Well, it depends on what restaurant you're dining in, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
You know, it can either be accordingly miserable experience or a pretty happy situation.
But you've done something of a survey of house wines, right?
Yeah, you know, because it's one of the trends that I've really taken notice of the past couple of years. And I think it's a correlative trend with this emphasis of restaurants on the importance of sommeliers and the sommeliers, you know, doing more than just, you know, putting together a wine list, but being actively involved in the creation of wine in many cases and creating signature wines, a.k.a. house wines, which is really interesting, though, because these guys that are creating the house wines were all, to a man, and they were all men, almost entirely resistant to the idea of calling them house wines. You know, so they, too, were affected by the pejorative nature of house wine, even though, of course, they were created in it, and making some really serious, really good wines, working with wineries like Cupé and Au Bon Climat, you know, two very high-profile California producers, some of them, you know, working with producers in Burgundy, and yet, at the same time, you know, resistant to this terrible moniker of house wine.
Well, this is very different, though, from the idea of what we think of as house wine. You're talking about a private label wine.
Yeah, exactly. And through my tasting, I certainly had a lot of bad house wine that wasn't this particular kind of, you know, cultivated effort. So I'm not to say that all house wine uniformly, you know, has gotten better. I would say the changes that have been made are significant. And I think that there really is. I mean, I think there's so much more ambition just about wine list in general and about wine in general that the you know, house wine was the next obvious thing to address. And it's also, let's be practical about it, a terrific moneymaker. I mean, these house wines that I was tasting were not cheap. And what I found that was interesting is that the Alan Stillman, you know, restaurant group, not only sold their house wines like the Smith Walensky, you know,
which
Cabernet,
is a restaurant in New York.
Yeah, sorry about that. But in there's a wine shop in New York that actually carries almost all the house wines of the Stillman Restaurant Group, which I thought was interesting. Cherry Lehman. Yeah. And Restaurant Danielle as well. So you could go there and find out that, hey, that wine actually cost not so very much retail and a whole lot in the restaurant.
Interesting. And Danielle meaning Chef Danielle Ballou in
Chef,
New York.
Right,
yeah,
right.
French
Restaurant
Chef.
Danielle.
Yeah. But now, do most places let you taste the house wine before you make a decision?
The places where I dined have, certainly. And I think that, you know, why wouldn't they? Presumably they're proud of that.
What, do you have a strategy for deciding whether or not to have the house wine when you're dealing with a more modest restaurant?
Well, aside from the strategy of tasting it, and if they won't let me taste it, then I won't, because I figure they're hiding something, probably with good reason.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You know, if they identify the house wine, that certainly gives me a lot more confidence. For example, there's a restaurant in New York called Orsay, And it's kind of a fabulous spot, much more fabulous than, you know, a place that I would normally dine, which is to say it's all very chic people. And it's more really about a place to be seen than necessarily to dine, although the food's pretty good. But they had this Côte d'Aron Blanc that I just thought was terrific. And it's by this superstar winemaker in the Rhone called Jean-Luc Colombo. And they made this really great house wine, but he was like, well, you could have it. It's okay. I thought there was an example of where they had this terrific house wine and seemed largely indifferent to it. But,
interesting.
I loved it. And it's very reasonably priced, too.
Huh. So. That's encouraging because paying the price of a bottle for a glass, even though the glass may be pretty spectacular, there's a downside to that sometimes.
Yeah. Well, there's always, I mean, I'm not a big by the glass fan, I have to say. If they'll let me taste the house wine, I'll even make a commitment to it by the bottle, which I understand is actually, from talking to wine directors, not the norm. I mean, they really count on selling it by the glass. With the exception to that is house champagne. You know, I think that is a much more likely by the glass scenario. But a couple guys didn't even know how much their house champagne cost by the bottle because they're like, well, we never sell it by the bottle. Who would drink the house champagne by the bottle?
Well, I would, but that's beside the point. Letty, thanks so much.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Letty Teague's article on house wines appeared in the March 2008 issue of Food & Wine magazine. It's time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table Refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things in the refrigerator, nothing with green fuzz on it or anything shriveled. I have to come up with a dish from those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. Now, the other judge is our celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Chris, welcome.
Welcome. Are you ready?
I'm ready. How tough are you feeling today?
I don't know. The question is, will there be little small jars of things in the refrigerator? But we're going to find out in a second. I think we have Bethany on the line. Bethany, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And where are you from?
I am proudly from Steamboat Springs, Colorado.
Oh, that's near my old stomping grounds. I used to live in Denver.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah. In fact, there was someone who used to raise the pigs and the lamb we used in my cooking school up in Steamboat Springs.
Do you guys know each other already or something?
Here we go again.
Anyway, to refresh our memories about the rules here, five ingredients from your refrigerator plus salt and pepper, and you also get water, Lynn. And finally, three additional items Lynn can request that you actually have on hand. So let's get started.
Sounds great. When I went to look at what I had in my fridge, I felt like I should have gone to the grocery store prior to calling in. But
oh, good.
So these are truly things that are in our fridge, and it's sadly a reflection on why I seem to be gaining that 5 or 10 pounds each year that you can never seem to lose.
We're in the same boat, girl. We're in the same boat. So what are the five ingredients?
We have lots of eggs.
Uh-huh.
And Swiss cheese.
Swiss.
And barbecue sauce. My husband has a barbecue restaurant. Keeps me out of the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
Sweet pickles.
Ooh, this is getting really interesting.
And then one of my favorites, flaky biscuits.
Okay, so we've got egg, Swiss cheese, barbecue sauce, sweet pickles, and flaky biscuits. I always call for...
How about a Boston butt? Maybe that would work out well here.
Yeah, but then...
barbecue sauce.
Ooh, I would like... No, I don't want that.
How about an Excedrin?
An Excedrin. All right, this is what we're going to do. Some egg salad, believe it or not. We're going to do a takeoff on a southern thing called pimento cheese.
Okay.
All right. Do you have any pimento peppers or green peppers?
We have red peppers.
Red
and
peppers.
Green peppers.
All right. I'd like some red peppers. All right.
Okay.
And I would like mayonnaise.
We have that too.
Do you have lemon or vinegar?
We have bottled lemon juice, or we have several types of vinegar.
I'd like a tart vinegar, preferably a cider, if that's possible.
Yep.
Maybe a 1935 with some good age on it, you know. No, but seriously, do you have any cider vinegar?
Yes, we do.
Okay, here's the deal.
What we're going to do is we're going to hard cook those eggs.
Okay.
Which is really easy because you just put the eggs in a saucepan and you put water over
them.
I'm
kind of the deviled egg queen.
Oh, you are.
Potlucks, you bet.
Okay, this is a takeoff on that concept.
Right up my alley.
All right, so you're
going to be the barbecue egg queen in about 20 seconds. Here.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll I think see. That gonna... sounds probably ready for a change, so this is a good thing.
Yeah, dice up some of the sweet pickles, chop up the eggs into... I would say you don't want them to be completely mushy. You want some chunks.
Okay.
You're going to dice up whatever amount of eggs you have. You want half that amount in Swiss cheese in a small dice. Dice up a large red pepper. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Dice up a couple of sweet pickles. And then what you're going to do is you're going to sprinkle a little bit of that vinegar over it and let that sit for a few minutes. You want those things to absorb the vinegar. And then what you're going to do, you're going to – is the barbecue
throw
sauce.
Throw out the barbecue sauce.
You're so
– great minds think
you're
alike.
Go ahead.
I'm waiting.
Difficult, Chris.
I'm waiting for the barbecue sauce.
Is the
sauce.
Barbecue sauce sweeter or hotter?
Sweeter.
All right. Mix the mayonnaise with the barbecue sauce so that you get something that tastes quite rich and is sweet. Tart, so you may want to put a few drops of the cider vinegar in there as well.
Okay.
Salt and pepper.
Great.
Yeah, salt and pepper, everything that you've got before you put in the mayonnaise, that whole chopped up business. You're going to heat up the biscuits and open them up. You're going to mix the mayo into this whole mixture, and you're going to serve warm biscuits with spoonfuls of this colorful, gorgeous, wonderful, sweet tart and everything else going on in it, crunchy.
Oh, my gosh.
Sort of pimento cheese thing. That we don't know what we're going to call, but that's what you're going to make.
This is why you're the professional. Sounds absolutely incredible.
No. The key is, would you eat it?
I would definitely eat it, and I think I would even enjoy looking at it, which would be pretty cool. We had a neat guy work at my husband's restaurant from Alaska, of all places, and his father always told him that the first bite is with the eye.
All right. Well, Chris, what do you think?
You know, for me, yeah. I wouldn't touch this, but your caller would eat it, and it was extremely creative with the barbecue sauce. I think you squeaked by this time, but this was just my She liked it. She liked it. I couldn't
Bethany, you are the best guest, and I really thank you for playing
It's an honor to be on, and we spend countless hours in our tractor plowing, and the only way we can make it positive is to time it around being able to listen to you in the radio. Luckily, we have a heated cab.
Thank you, ma'am. That's very kind of you. Thanks for playing Stump the
Thank
Cook.
Thank you very, very
Great
much.
Great job. Thank you.
And thank you, Chris.
You did it again.
Christopher Kimball's day job is editor of Cook's Illustrated magazine and host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. Now, if you want to play Stump the Cook, give us a call at 800-537-5252 and leave us a message. One of our sneaky producers may call you with an invite to play. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, in the supermarket, which lettuce is better, the head from the bottom of the pile or the one from the top? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But right now, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, in the supermarket, which lettuce is better, the head from the bottom of the pile or the one from the top? Well, the answer is the lettuce from the top of the pile. Why? Well, according to internist Dr. John LaPuma, author of ChefMD's Big Book of Culinary Medicine, the supermarket lights help the lettuce retain and even increase their flavonoids. Flavonoids suppress destructive oxygen-free radicals. Now, the research was done by a plant physiologist, Charles Caldwell. He found that fluorescent lights in supermarkets can increase flavonoids in lettuce. Now, apparently, they emit small amounts of UV rays. Those rays affect the nutrients. Another plant physiologist carried this idea further. Stephen Britz found that by exposing greenhouse-grown lettuces to ultraviolet B lights, you can double and even triple the amount of flavonoids they contain. Now, I ask you, Is this not a marketing opportunity waiting to happen?
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call. You call me, tell me, and I'll be around. If it seems you're...
Okay, it is time to open the lines for your calls. Join us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is waiting patiently? We have got Sally on the line from Bainbridge Island in Washington State. Sally, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking the call.
Oh, you are welcome.
I'm busy working all day, but I love to cook when I get home, but I kind of like to keep it fast, and I love to do stir fries.
Right.
Now, I really love the taste of olive oil, but I know that if you cook it at fairly high heat, it can break down.
Right.
Or maybe not have such a good flavor. So I didn't know if you had specific recommendations for good oils that taste good that you can stir fry with.
Well, as you get into these temperatures, you know, oils, different oils have different burn points. Olive oils is fairly low, but I have to tell you, people have been frying with olive oil in the Mediterranean forever, you know.
Yeah.
And I was raised on it where you'd have a half inch in the pan and you would do a pan frying of, you know, something. And I never remember it tasting rancid. I've done it myself, or tasting bad. But with stir frying, where you have super high heat, generally what's recommended is an oil with what's called a high burn point. In so many words, the oil doesn't start to smoke or break down in any way until it gets to around 400 or 450. So
Okay. When
you're talking about those oils, a lot of them don't have super, how would you call it, super distinctive flavors. But you're talking safflower has one of the highest. Okay.
Okay.
That's one. Another one is peanut oil, which is
okay. Very
much favored, you know, when you get into Asian cooking. And another one is sesame oil. I don't mean the roasted sesame seeds, the kind that you use in Chinese cooking. I mean the clear stuff. The other
okay. Thing
you want to do is never use a hydrogenated oil for health reasons. That's where trans fats come from.
Okay. Right.
You want what's called either expeller pressed or cold pressed. Essentially, that means the same thing. When you hydrogenate an oil, you probably know this, it's been treated with heat. It changes the structure and it changes the nutrients. But it also changes its burn point.
Oh.
And, I've stir-fried, for goodness sakes, with extra virgin olive oil, and it has not – I don't know. Maybe I'm doing something that's very unhealthy, but I like the taste because sometimes I'm doing a Western-style dish, but I'm doing it in the wok.
Right.
Yeah,
that's what I like, too.
Yeah. But I would say if you want to really play it safe, I would go for the safflower, the sesame, or the peanut oil, and you're home free.
Great.
Okay?
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
You are welcome. And you do live, as you well know, in one of the loveliest places in the country.
I do. I feel lucky.
Yeah. Hey, Sally, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Take care. Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. We've got Lauren calling from Starksboro, Vermont. Hey, Lauren, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, I have a catering business in the higher regions of Vermont.
Uh-huh.
And most of my work is done in the summer, doing catering
right. For
weddings. And in the winter, I do a lot of testing of my recipes and try to kind of culminate different things and try
right. Things
out that I haven't normally, you know, that I don't normally offer. So I have a question about one thing that's gone through many transformations. The components of it are, it's a honeyed goat cheese.
Yeah.
It has a dollop of caramelized onions.
Honeycrisp.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. Where are we going now?
We're going to a Honeycrisp apple,
right. Fresh,
and it's served on, well, this is the part that I have a question about. Originally, it was served on a puff pastry, but I found that it was just too oily and heavy for summer.
Yeah, yeah. So what are you trying to use then instead?
Well, the second incarnation was I made kind of like a shortbread.
Yeah.
But I kind of took out the sugar, most of the sugar,
mm-hmm.
but I found it was just too much like a cookie. And I'm trying to get, what I'm trying for is I want something that's going to crunch like a nut. And I was using almond flour for my shortbread.
Yeah.
So I was thinking something almondy, something to give it an earthy quality.
Yeah.
And but I want it to crunch like a nut, and I want it to snap like a cracker. And I'm not really a baker. I'm more into the savory thing. So,
you're not asking for much, are you?
Yeah, right. So, so what can you offer me?
Now, is this going to be finger food? I mean, is this like you're going to do
these are morsels of goodness, yes.
Morsels of goodness. I like that. I like your style.
All right.
Okay, this, oh boy.
So you've got the honeyed goat cheese, the caramelized onions, and the apple, and it wants to be on something crunchy.
Yeah, you do want something crunchy with all of that. I mean, the apple has crunch, but it would be great to have that compliment.
And then the clincher is I need to be able to prepare it at least a day or two ahead of time.
Yeah, but I wouldn't fill it a day or two ahead of time.
No. That's
right. But you want to be able to have the crust or whatever it goes on. Have you tried working with a basic pie crust, if we want to get fancy and call it the French name pâte brisée?
Not really.
Well, think about this. A basic pie crust, and your proportions can vary. It can be as buttery as you want it to be, but I don't think with the richness of the goat cheese and the honey and everything else, you want it that fatty. But usually it's something like 4 ounces of butter to 1.5 to 2 cups of flour. You can do it even 1 cup to, 4 ounces of butter to 1 cup of flour to make it very rich. And then there's salt, and then there's egg, and then there's cold water or white wine or, orange juice or, apple juice or whatever. But this is what I'm wondering. I add nuts to that all the time.
Okay.
And what I'm wondering is if you don't use almond flour.
Right.
Take whole almonds because they're going to have the most flavor. Toast them. And then coarse chop them in your food processor. Chop them so they're no thicker or bigger than the thickness you want your...
Are we talking whole almonds with the skin on?
Or yeah, I would use them with the skin on. I mean,
slivered,
yeah,
skinless
no.
Ones.
The slivered skinless ones are the most tasteless pieces of waste I have ever come across. I have no patience with them. So that's why I'd rather start with, if you can only get skin on whole almonds, get those. If you can get skin off, it'll just be paler.
Okay.
It's just, but the idea is try making a basic pie crust with no sugar, with salt instead. Now, know that you can flavor this any way you want. You could have black pepper in it.
Yeah.
You could have herbs in it.
Could I put Parmesan in there? That would probably be
too much. Well, you could put a bit of Parmigiano in there if you wanted to. But the point is, now you can roll this out. You could put it into little tins, to make little individual things. Or you could roll this out on a cookie, put it on a cookie sheet, and before you put it in the oven, do a zigzag cut to create little squares or triangles that then you could put the goat cheese on. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And this will keep. The other thing to consider is homemade crackers.
Yes.
They're a bake, if you
go. That's kind of what I was thinking with, I almost was thinking of something like a Tuile or a Tui,
Well, a Tuile would be great. The only problem with it is that is more fragile. You have to fool with that. Three things to try. First of all, check out recipes for homemade crackers. Online, you'll find them. Any big baking book, maybe even Joy of Cooking, will have crackers. And remember, when you have a cracker recipe, again, you can flavor it any way you want. You can put a little onion in it, anything.
Yeah.
You can do the exact same thing with a pie crust, which you can fool with depending on how buttery you want it to be. The more butter, the more fragile. All right?
Yes.
And then the third thing would be work with the Tuile. That very thin, airy, almost like cookie, but try doing it with very little sugar in it. A little sugar with what you're talking about, by the way, would not be bad.
Right.
A little bit of sweetness.
I want it to still maintain its savory.
Yeah.
Quality.
I mean, there's no reason why there can't be bits of red onion and sugar in something, a tad of sugar. Yeah. So that's my thought. I think that may help you at least, one of those is going to work.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I hope this all works for you.
All right. Thanks, Lynn.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Call us 800-537-5252. 52. For a lot of us, the produce aisle is more about angst than the joys of Mother Nature. You stand there debating between low prices and pesticides and higher prices and organics. Well, there's some research that will help you out. Richard Wiles is the executive director and co-founder of the Environmental Working Group. Now, they've developed a shopper's guide to pesticides in produce. Richard, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Richard, what is the Environmental Working Group?
Well, we're basically a watchdog group. We're an environmental watchdog organization with offices in Washington, D.C. and Oakland, California.
And how do you go about evaluating the presence of pesticides and the lack of them?
This list that we put together almost 15 years ago is based entirely on government data. So what we do is we go to the USDA testing programs, we get all of their computer records, and we just simply analyze them for which fruits and vegetables have the most pesticides on them and the highest levels of pesticides on them after they've been washed and prepared to eat. That's a very important factor here, that these rankings are based on foods after government-certified washers have already tried to wash the pesticides off them.
Ah, can washing at home before serving or before cooking have any effect on the presence of the pesticides?
Absolutely. Washing can reduce the levels of some pesticides, but it won't take a pesticide that's heavily contaminated. You can't wash it down to the low contaminated part of the list. So this list is, everything on here has already been washed, is what I'm trying to say. So you can't change your ranking by washing your peach.
I understand. So, because I was very surprised to see that under the list of what you call the dirty dozen and the vegetables it's best to buy organic were potatoes.
There's a lot of post-harvest pesticides applied to potatoes, particularly one chemical that tends to show up at pretty high levels. So since the amount of the pesticide on the fruit or vegetable is one of our criteria, potatoes kind of scored high.
So eating the skin is not a good idea unless it's an organic potato.
Yeah, I mean, what we're saying here is that you can find fruits and vegetables that are pretty routinely have low pesticide levels on them. And, when you can't find organic or organic looks too expensive, you can use this list to help you make those decisions. For example, pineapples or mango or kiwi and bananas are pretty consistently very low in pesticides. So the same would be true for eggplant and broccoli and asparagus and frozen peas and those kind of things. So you can definitely, eat some low pesticide foods without paying the premium for organic, if that's what you want to do. On the other hand, there are many fruits and vegetables that are consistently high in pesticides, after they're washed year in and year out. And, that would be like peaches and apples, strawberries, nectarines, cherries, those kind of things. And that's where we recommend, that paying the extra money for the organic.
Yeah.
If you're concerned about pesticides, you really should make that choice there.
I see. Well, you have potatoes on that list of high in pesticides, spinach.
Yep.
Lettuce, grapes, and pears. What surprised me was that broccoli was relatively low in pesticides. I had always understood that because of all those little buds, there was just more surface for pesticides to be present.
I think broccoli is a pretty tough plant when you compare it to, say, a strawberry, right, or an apple, where growers tend to be very concerned about superficial blemishes. I mean, we're talking about conventional produce here, where sometimes the criteria for spraying the pesticide aren't one that, we might agree with. We would say hold off on those last two sprays if you're just doing it to control some minor cosmetic blemish. But, in most cases, those pesticide sprays will happen. Whereas with broccoli, you don't really have that concern. You might control the insects very early in the season, and then, 50 days later, the broccoli's harvested.
Just proves the point. There's a great deal you have to know and understand.
Right, so we just look at the numbers and rank it. We're not making any decisions here. This is what the government data show, and it's pretty consistent year in and year out.
Well, and we can go online and download this guide.
Exactly, EWG.org, environmentalworkinggroup.org, and it's right there for you to download.
Well, Richard, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Richard Wiles is executive director and co-founder of the Environmental Working Group. Now, for information on their shopper's guide to pesticides in produce, go to the website splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime, even mid-saute. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this quote from Anita Manning, who said, "High-tech tomatoes, mysterious milk, super squash. Are we supposed to eat this stuff, or is it going to eat us?" Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. American Public Media programs explore the American dream and ask, after our current troubles are over, what's next? More at nextamericandream.org. Information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. You're going to find podcasts, newsletters, info on our book, How to Eat Supper, and a newly formed collection of inexpensive recipes we're calling Cheap Eats, gathered from our recipe archive. So don't miss out. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin and Judy Graham. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.